Did you ever read Jack Kerouac's On the Road?
I hated the book. I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it.
Sometimes I'm walking on the ground, and I see right through the ground. And there is no world.
A half century after it became the first great American hipster novel, we're still trying to decide whether it was actually great or just a trendy 50s flash in the pan.
If you just give into it, it's going to overtake you in some way.
Also today, a performer trained to sing opera brings her singular sound to indie rock.
You are the brightest diamond.
Cheryl Warden of My Brightest Diamond is here to perform live in our studio. I'm Kurt Anderson. That's ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
For miles and miles and miles and miles.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, one of the most interesting, haunting voices in indie rock, Cheryl Warden of My Brightest Diamond, performs live. And 60 years after Jack Kerouac memorialized his road trip on paper, would-be bohemians are still thrilling to it. But first, Belarus is Europe's last totalitarian regime. They still have a secret police they still call the KGB, which still rounds up artists for doing unauthorized work. A couple of years ago on this show, we featured the Belarus Free Theater, which presented political plays often in secret.
Usually we perform in private apartments and private houses of our friends.
Natalia Kolada co-founded the company.
Or we could perform in the woods when it's summertime.
Really? And you're the word has gotten out by means of text messaging?
Text messaging, and mostly it's internet through blogs.
The theater's principals have gone completely underground until they managed just now to escape to New York City. They're presenting a show called Being Harold Pinter. After last month's sham presidential election in Belarus, the Belarusian KGB cracked down on the opposition, and Kolada was one of the hundreds of people arrested at the protests. She was jammed into a KGB van with dozens of other women.
It was totally dark there, and the guy who was staying in that van, he said, lay down, face down on the floor of the van. And then he was telling us what would happen to us, that we should be taken to the forest, we should be raped, and Nazi time will seem to you like a dream. And this is the most horrible part of all of it, because every third Belarusian was killed by a Nazi. And when you hear this, you understand what they do to those people, how they brainwash them, that they could talk to their co-citizens this way.
Did you assume he was just saying horrible things, or did you fear for your safety and life?
At some point, I got so many threats in my life. And I knew that if he got this order, there is no doubt that he will do it. And then we got to jail. We've been told that we should go one by one. And I got to the first floor, and there were hundreds of men staying facing walls. And when you see one floor with men, you are shocked. But when I got to a second floor and there was just women facing the walls, it was double shock for me.
The so people facing the walls sounds like a horrible kind of theatrical moment.
Exactly. And as it appeared with our international coordinator who was arrested as well, he was staying like that for 3 days. But we were lucky we were staying inside. People were staying outside and then...
Outdoors. In late December.
Yeah, it was snow under your knee. And when they wanted to ask for drink, they said just eat snow instead of water.
So you were held for 24 hours?
Yeah.
Why or how did you get released?
I got out, it was just absolutely stupid judicial mistake that was done by policemen. They started my case under my name, but they ended up with another name. And the judge, she just started to scream to policemen, and she said to them that you set me up and I will not take such a responsibility.
And that's why you were freed.
Yeah. After that, she said, you are lucky that it's happened, so you will get only a fine.
You went to Washington last week and met with people at the United States State Department. What did you tell them in your meetings?
Oh, I think it was a very important meeting, and today I just got the news that in Vilnius, the representative of the State Department warned Belarusian regime that if political prisoners are not released, the sanctions will go into force in a few days. So I believe that was absolutely amazing result, but I'm not sure that Belarusian government is scared.
Although it's not a total rogue state, the Belarusian government wants economic involvement with the European Union. They care about what the rest of the world thinks, do they not?
Belarusian government cares about money because there is no economy in Belarus. It's destroyed many years ago, and it depended only on Russian money, and it depended on political prisoners, as we call them now, hostages. We have a terrorist and we have hostages. And in order to free these hostages, European Union always gave money to a terrorist.
So you're saying that your president, Lukashenko, is the terrorist holding political prisoners hostage and then taking European money to release them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is the time for world leaders to understand that this guy is criminal. And it's not possible to talk to him. You just need to behave with him as you will do to a criminal.
Does your situation, this bizarre, temporary, one hopes, exile situation, affect the way you can do your work?
I think in reality we get ideas when we travel because we have absolutely unique chance to see beyond the box. And we have a chance to speak to people and to get absolutely another feeling of life. Because when we stay inside, it's like just four walls around you. And
breathing the same air and
absolutely, and you
seeing
just,
the same terrible things.
You just feel squeezed all the time. But there is such a force in actors' energy and actors' stories. Because majority of our performances, they are based on our own stories and stories of our friends.
As victims of political repression?
No, not no? just victims, absolutely. They are talking about religion, about sexual minorities, about national minorities, about lost possibilities.
The normal material of theatrical art.
Yeah, absolutely. But everything becomes taboo zone in Belarus because it's not open for public people are not allowed to think. Authorities do whatever is possible not to allow people to think about even their own lives.
Natalia Kolada, co-founder of the Belarus Free Theater. I spoke with her last week. To my mind, one of the good things happening in music now is that the old thick membrane between classical music and pop has begun to dissolve some. There's a whole generation of younger musicians who can compose and play orchestral music, but who grew up on rock, pop, and punk. So instead of getting all angsty about this, they take the best and brightest parts of pop songwriting and merge that with the rigors of their classical training. One of these very modern hybrid artists is the singer-songwriter, or I guess I should say singer-composer, Cheryl Warden. She performs as My Brightest Diamond, and the old-school musical establishment is starting to open the gates. Warden is performing at Lincoln Center next week as part of their American Songbook series. Cheryl Warden, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
How does it feel to be at age 36 anointed into this canon of American popular music?
Well, we're very excited about it, and it is a real honor for me, having come up from a classical background, and then to sort of be presented by Lincoln Center as a songwriter. It just feels really nice.
You can express your pleasure.
I'm delighted.
What do you think makes a song worthy of being included in such a thing as the American Songbook?
I guess I can only apply that for myself. So I wanted to present something that feels classically American and then end up kind of with our rock show.
Uh-huh. But when you say, I'm going to create American songs, how do you do that? Do you just play Aaron Copland at full blast for a few nights or what?
I've been listening to a lot of Annie.
Yeah.
I guess I have my ear, maybe subconsciously, has been listening to a lot of the older American musicals, and I think that has continued to be a really strong influence for me.
Really? Like Rodgers and Hammerstein?
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to go wrong with any of those.
It is.
Can you play something new for us?
Yes, I will.
And what will this be?
This song is called We Added It Up, and this is the first time anyone has heard this.
Good.
This is a debut.
Is there a story we need to know behind this?
Well, President Obama made the shellacking speech.
After the election losses of last fall.
Yes. And at the end of the speech, he said, we need to learn to disagree without being disagreeable. So I started thinking about that, about politicians and ideas and lovers and atoms, things that have opposite characters, yet they work together, and realize that our entire planet is held together by opposites.
Let's hear it.
All right.
There was you, there was me. We never could agree if I was up, you were down. You were there, I was here. A grand puppeteer stuck it all together. If I was cat, you were the dog. If I was tied up, you were a hog. If I was flat, you were a ball. If I was charged, then you were cash. If I was tux, you were the mash. If I was loud, then you were shh. We love binds the world. suppose.
I love that. I love that. That was the world premiere of Cheryl Warden performing We Added It Up. That was great. And I have a question about one of the lines. I heard confusion makes the world go round. Did you also say fusion makes the world go round?
Yes, I did.
Oh, well, then I'm hearing correctly. That was a lovely, lovely song.
Thank you.
Rock music and pop music, certainly since the Beatles, have incorporated orchestral arrangements and instrumentation.
Absolutely.
You, however, unlike I'm sure the Beatles themselves would admit, the remaining ones, know what you're doing, right? I mean, they didn't really understand orchestral composition.
They just got somebody,
the London Symphony, to do it for them, right?
And they did a pretty great job.
Did you like that kind of music, the kinds of rock and pop that incorporated those elements growing up or not?
I grew up listening to a lot of soul music. So there are strings all over.
And horns.
And horns all over those Motown records and Nina Simone.
Right. As I was thinking about what you were doing and how beautifully, this beautiful hybrid you've made and sort of singular hybrid you've made, that I was thinking, how do I experience classical music differently than I experience rock music? And one difference is classical music, I sit there and sort of dream my own dream and create my own story, whereas in pop, you're being told a story, a very specific story. Is that a difference for you as well?
That's interesting. I think for me, I always want to have some element of universality in the music. So it could be about many, many different things.
So it's not just be my baby, be my baby, be my baby.
Yeah, although I've had a baby, and now suddenly that lyric might have a different meaning to me.
Well, and I see your baby over there in the control room is being held by a man I presume is your husband. Has that made your already complicated life more complicated and difficult?
It's made it far more joyous. I can, you know...
You can tell me off the air.
I'm serious. Is, so. This kid is like... he's a ray of sunshine.
Well, he is certainly, I'll say, for the listeners who can't see him, a beautiful Gerber baby.
Thank you.
Will you play another song?
Yes, I will.
And what will this be?
This is called From the Top of the World, and it's based on a book by George MacDonald called At the Back of the North Wind. And so it's kind of my take on that book.
Cool.
At the end of the sea, there waits my wind to carry me. Through storms we will sail just to gaze at the top. Looked up the sun, the moon,
made up our minds to arrive. Smiling, yes, we made up our minds to touch the height of life and find out what we
That was Cheryl Warden performing From the Top of the World live here in Studio 360, along with a whole bunch of musicians, more than I think we've ever had in this room while I've been here. Who are they?
This chamber ensemble is Y Music, and today we have the lovely Brian Wolf on drums and Nathan Lithgow on bass.
Cheryl Warden, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Cheryl Warden performs as part of Lincoln Center's American Songbook series later this month, and you can see a video of her performance here and now at studio360.org anytime you'd like. Coming up, when a newly married couple hits their first big awkward moment, she really didn't like his favorite novel.
I think it's uncool that he's lusting after girls who are like 16 and younger. And I think it's uncool that Dean Moriarty, the character who's supposed to be the coolest, marries three women and he's actively looking for more women to sleep with on the side. That's your hero?
Jack Kerouac's On the Road. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. 60 years ago, Jack Kerouac sat down at his desk, fed a 40-yard scroll of paper into his typewriter, and started banging out a novel. Jacked up on coffee and probably Benzedrine, 3 weeks later, he'd produced On the Road. And pretty much at that moment, the Beat Generation was born.
The solitude of the actual oneness of the unbornness of the unborn essence of everything. Comma? Nay, the true pure foreverhood. That big blank potential that can ray forth anything it wants from its pure store. That blazing bliss.
We're listening to Jack Kerouac, age 37, reading from his article called Is There a Beat Generation in 1959.
Why should I attack what I love out of life? This is beat. Live your lives out? Nah. Love your lives out.
Was Kerouac chemically altered at the time? Maybe. Or maybe he was just high on success.
But that wild eager picture of me on the cover of the book On the Road, where I look so beat.
2 years earlier, 1957, his novel, On the Road, had been published, and it was that rare thing, a cutting-edge work of literature that was also a huge instant bestseller. We asked two of our contributors, Hilary Frank and Jonathan Menjivar, why the book still speaks to readers, especially young readers, the would-be beatniks who've come along decade after decade since. But it turned out that Hilary had never read it. So Jonathan gave her his beloved copy with all the underlinings and scribbles from when he was 17 years old. And some marital tension was thus provoked.
So far, I'm not entertained.
What do you mean?
I'm on what? Page 109. And I just feel like nothing's happened, and he's heading on his way back to the East Coast. Because he's, like, failed at I don't even know what. I don't know what he was setting out to do.
But I think, like, the thing of it is that what happens doesn't really matter. It's more about this feeling. Like, if you just give into it, it's going to overtake you in some way.
That was 3 weeks ago. I could see what Hillary was saying, but picking up the book now, I still fall for the way Kerouac puts words together. I thought my friend Davy Rothbart might be better at articulating what makes me like the book so much. Davy pretty much lives his life as if he's a character and on the road, touring the country every year, promoting this magazine he makes called Found. He stays on people's floors, in their basements, the side of the road.
When you wake up in like a little gully and there's kind of frost on the weeds around you and you just feel like rugged and, I don't know, you feel cool. I mean, you know, that's what part of On the Road is about, and that's what part of some of the reason people seized on it. But I just don't think it's only a mythic allure. I think, like, it's real.
That right there, that gets to the heart of why I think On the Road, even with its flaws, is something special. There's an energy and a romance that I know Hill should get. Davy fell for the book in the same way I did when he was a kid. In a lot of ways, he felt like he was Sal Paradise, the character who's kind of Kerouac's proxy in the book. Sal was a writer.
He also is falling in love with girls, like, every city they go to.
Right.
And that really matched my experience. I think for me, that was actually one of the most powerful things about the book, Sal's longing for girls. And the way that mm-hmm. he can spot somebody in some roller rink or in some bar or just walking down the street and just feel so overwhelmingly in love that it just makes his heart, you know, miserable.
I think that's one thing that a lot of women, and certainly Hillary, respond really negatively to. Sure, he's falling in love with all these women, but then he's leaving them all behind. Do you think you have to be a boy to really understand that?
I don't know. Like, yeah, maybe it is this sort of romantic thing that's not that cool if you're the girl that's left behind.
The thing is, it's not so much that I think it's uncool of him to be leaving girls behind. I think it's uncool that he's lusting after girls who are, like, 16 and younger. And I think it's uncool that Dean Moriarty, the character who's supposed to be the coolest, marries three women and kind of rotates between all of them. And he's actively looking for more women to sleep with on the side. That's your hero?
I mean, isn't everyone you look at that's cool? You're overlooking some major flaw?
That's my friend Molly Eigen. Back in high school, she was obsessed with On the Road. She even went on a road trip where she packed herself bologna sandwiches, just like Sal Paradise does. I guess I wonder, like, why overlook their attitudes towards women? Did that stuff not bother you?
I remember being bothered by it, but I do remember thinking, like, I would be the woman that was, like, in with them. Like, I would be the one woman that they would be like, oh, I'll take her seriously, and she's not like the other women, and unlikely.
I think I figured out what the problem is. Jonathan?
Uh-huh?
I think I'm too old for On the Road.
What makes you say that?
Molly read it in high school. So did you. So did Davy. I think maybe it's just a teen thing. Here, let's do this. Let's go to a high school English class that's reading On the Road and see what actual teenagers think of it.
I hated the book. All right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized, and I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Hillary, that's not a real person. That's a TV show. It's Kim Kelly from Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, but Kim Kelly is exactly the kind of kid who should love On the Road. She drinks, she has sex, she doesn't give a damn. Let's talk to Rebecca Kirshner. She wrote Kim Kelly's lines in that scene.
It felt refreshing and cool for Kim Kelly to say that the book stunk because it's like you're so afraid to criticize great works of art that it's like, oh yeah, That emperor is not wearing clothes.
I figured Rebecca would be all rebellious like Kim Kelly and she'd commiserate with me.
She didn't?
Well, she's not in love with the book now, but she did like it in high school, so she gets why a lot of teens are into it. And she still sees something in it, too.
I don't know. It's sort of cute how... Okay, this is what it is. Like, how much of a rebel are you if you have time to sit down and type something up? I mean, you're not out getting drunk or having a knife fight and, you know, whether you're Hemingway or you're Kerouac or something. It's like, well, yeah, but you're kind of nerds because you're writers, really, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
At that age, also, you're sort of testing different identities. And, like, every book is a way of being a different person.
Right. Hillary, I think I just want you to see what the high school me would have been moved by.
It's hard when somebody you really care about just doesn't get or like something that is really important to you.
That's my friend Davey Rothbard again.
You know, I know Hillary. She's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like anybody who has a curiosity about the people we share the world with is someone that would like this book.
I think that's a terrible attitude. It's a poor understanding of the book to just think it's a barometer of coolness.
John Leland wrote a book called Why Kerouac Matters. I figured he could help answer my biggest question about On the Road, why people like it so much when it just doesn't feel well written. One of the first things you learn in a creative writing class is show, don't tell. And to me, this book is all telling. I never feel like I'm put in the moment.
Yes, we have made an icon of a book that's unevenly written. But the descriptive scene of the brothel in Mexico, which becomes increasingly more hallucinatory as they go along,
mm-hmm.
I think is a really vivid scene.
And that's also one of the scenes that kind of turned my stomach, because that's the one where, you know, he's lusting after this 15-year-old girl.
But poor Sal, he's a step slow all the time, and there he is. He's in this brothel, and he still can't approach the girl that he's really interested in.
Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, I don't want to see him get the girl that he wants in that situation because she's so young.
And so he doesn't.
Right.
So, you know, you can go away happy that her her virtue, such as it is, remains uncompromised, at least by Sal Paradise.
Touché.
But also, don't think of it just as Dean's book. I mean, it's easy to read the book as this celebration of men behaving badly. But Sal keeps himself at a distance from Dean's behavior and really is able to put it behind him. Think of it as Sal's book in addition to Dean's book.
And what will I get out of that?
You'll get a book about the things that male friends go through. You know, they go through this sexual admiration. There's really a great love affair. They burn pretty hot, and then they get mad at one another, and they fall out, which I think men are never able to show in real life or in their depictions of their friendships.
Yeah, you know what's happening is that I'm starting to like the book more just from talking to you about it. You know, I think your interpretation of it is making me feel more fond of it.
Oh, good. Well, I'm not really trying to sell the book. That's not my job.
I'm not trying to sell the book to you either. It's not like I'm going to love you any less if you don't like it. I just want you to see that there are moments that are great.
Well, there's this one part that I marked. It's near the end, you know, when they're in Mexico, and Sal's trying to sleep in the car, and it's just way too hot in there. So he gets out of the car, and he gets on the roof, because he just wants to feel the cool metal on his skin. And he lies there on his back, and there's still no breeze, and the mosquitoes are eating him alive.
And what do you think of that?
Well, I guess it's this one moment where I can really feel what's going on with him. All he can do to get through that night is give in to the heat and the mosquitoes and kind of let his blood and the bugs become one. Right there, he really does what I want a writer to do.
Is it okay that it makes me happy to hear you say that?
Yeah, of course.
Hillary Frank and Jonathan Minhibar live in Philadelphia. Coming up, if highway signs look fuzzy to you, don't fidget with your glasses. Get a new sign.
Opening it up, widening the typeface. There were minuscule changes, but they could be seen at 900 feet.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. Today, we are remembering Jack Kerouac's On the Road. The year that Kerouac's book was published happened to be the same year my family began its annual summer ritual of the long driving vacation to the Dakotas, to Montana, to Canada, to the Deep South. This big Chevy station wagon, no air conditioning, no seat belts, two-lane blacktops, and the exciting brand new interstate highways. Somewhere on some highway, we might have passed another family doing the very same thing, the Friedlanders. Lee Friedlander was an up-and-coming fine art photographer back then. He used those trips of his to make a lot of the black-and-white images that established him as one of the most acute modern chroniclers of America. Young Eric, the Friedlander's son, grew up to become a cellist, but a cellist who didn't stick to the old Bach, Beethoven, Brahms repertoire. He recorded an album of original music inspired by those Friedlander family trips, all performed on solo cello. It's called Block Ice and Propane.
When I started writing the music, it had this Americana and this roots feel to it, and what I often do is just sit with the cello and kind of improvise and try to develop, like, if I have a good start, I want to figure out the rest of the song. And these memories started filtering back, these memories of these trips that I took with my family every summer, my whole life, practically. And the block ice was an obligation that you had to fulfill because we had to get the big block of ice because otherwise the food would go stale. Actually, the original title was Block Ice, Tongue, and Propane. My father, there was a stretch when he began preparing tongue in the pressure cooker for lunch almost all the time. And
you talk in the liner notes beautifully about this sort of magical memories of driving at night in particular.
Yeah, well, you know, we did something then, which I'm sure is completely illegal now that you just can't do, is what my sister and I would ride. We had a camper shell that sat on top of a 66 Chevrolet pickup. And, you know, we sat above the cab looking out the big picture window of the camper. And you know, and at the end of these trips, we would get to kind of like Ohio or somewhere like that, and it was just, let's hit the turnpikes and get home. And that meant driving late into the night. And we would just sit up there kind of dozing and listening to the radio or playing games, but also turn out the lights and just look out that window. And this is the magic of night driving. I still have a feeling for that now.
And the song on this record, Night White, is inspired by that set of memories.
Yeah.
Record, there is a fairly radical bipolarity, if not variety, between these sort of beautiful American rootsy songs like the one you just played and a song called Yakima. And then there's these dissonant modern pieces as well, seemingly from, I mean, they could be from two different records. What appeals to you about doing both things?
I wanted to carry a technique I started with my first record, which was to improvise live in the studio and bring that kind of on-the-spot feeling to the record. So I did that, and I really like the way the contrasts work because it gives you a kind of darker place to go and where from when you exit that area and back into the kind of sweetness of the plucked pieces, you feel kind of refreshed and ready to hear one of those again.
Well, we're going to take you up on that. And we warned you that we were going to ask you to improvise something, but you don't know what I'm going to ask you to improvise off of.
That's true.
It is from Jack Kerouac's On the Road, early on in the book, and I will read it. a guy with a kind of tool shack on wheels, a truck full of tools that he drove standing up like a modern milkman, gave me a ride up the long hill, where I immediately got a ride from a farmer and his son heading out for Adel in Iowa. In this town, under a big elm tree near a gas station, I made the acquaintance of another hitchhiker, a typical New Yorker, an Irishman who'd been driving a truck for the post office most of his work years and was now headed for a girl in Denver and a new life. I think he was running away from something in New York, the law, most likely. He was a real red-nosed young drunk of 30 and would have bored me ordinarily, except that my senses were sharp for any kind of human friendship. He wore a beat sweater and baggy pants and had nothing with him in the way of a bag, just a toothbrush and handkerchiefs. He said we ought to hitch together. I should have said no, because he looked pretty awful on the road. But we stuck together and got a ride with a taciturn man to Stewart, Iowa, a town in which we were really stranded. Very cool. Thank you very much. That was Eric Friedlander improvising a song that you, he, and I heard for the very first time, inspired by Jack Kerouac's, or a passage of Jack Kerouac's, On the Road. Eric Friedlander, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you. Since my conversation with Eric Friedlander, his music has become a fixture in my own rotation, and you can hear another piece he performed here live at studio360.org. His latest album is called 50 Miniatures for Improvising Quintet. In the days before baby boomers like Eric Friedlander and I were driving around America with our families, way back in the 40s and 30s, road signs were not uniform at all. They were more like bits of graphic folk art, hand-painted, usually in all capital letters, because lowercase was hard to render with a brush. When federal highways started becoming standardized in the late 50s and 60s, so did the signs, but with very little thought given to the design. And now, as more and more drivers get older and their headlights get brighter, the original interstate highway typeface is looking a little fuzzy, to a lot of people anyway, and you know who you are. And that's where graphic designer Don Meeker comes in. In this week's Design for the Real World, he explains how he helped bring highway signs back into focus.
In President Eisenhower's term, they said, we need standard highway signs nationwide because we have these new freeways. So we can take a missile from Altoona, PA to Albuquerque really very fast. It's kind of funny to hear. The reason for that highway system was to mobilize the country in the Cold War.
What's wrong with this picture? The common everyday spectacle of modern traffic on roads that are as out of date as the covered wagon.
For the freeway signs, there was a new development, a mixed-case typeface. It was developed by a man named Ted Forbes from Leroy Lettering. Well, Leroy Lettering, an engineer or an architect, will remember, was used to label drawings. So he made these letters, blew them up photographically, and created a typeface. That's all he knew. That's what was available to him in 1949. And from that came Highway Gothic Series E Modified. The astonishing thing is that that has lived for 58 years.
I've been traveling this road a long, long time. I'm starting to get the blues.
The roadscape, however, has become much, much more complex. The two-lane freeway is now a four-lane freeway. Urban driving, the old rural route out of town, now is filled with all sorts of commercial clutter.
Road signs and middle lines are hypnotizing me.
So I think the competition for your eye has become greater, yet the side of the road where you place signs has not become wider.
Road signs and middle lines will be the death of me.
There's no reason why we have to be living if computers were regulated like highway signs, we'd still be living with vacuum tubes. Intel would be making vacuum tubes. They wouldn't be making microchips. And so in the late 80s, the federal government became aware that the driving population was getting older. They were also aware of these new high-brightness materials and the halation effect. Well, halation is when your headlights shine into the material, it reflects back to you. So if that is not properly balanced for your eye, the white will be so much more intense that it will overshadow the letter form or become much too bright. And the sign can be a big glare, which they can't discern what they're reading. So the flaw of the standard E-modified, the upper lowercase typeface that you see on freeway signs, is that it has a consistent stroke width. It's like strapping two pencils together and pulling them around in a full circle. That makes the interior shapes or the counters of the typeface very small. It is quite squat, short, and quite heavy. There were a number of studies done, and the final results were just make everything 20% larger. Well, a 20% larger cap high increases the size of the sign by 50%. Were it possible, the cost would be in the billions.
What's a citizen gonna do?
And so we looked at the typefaces and realized finally that we were going to have to start from scratch.
Our American dream of Futurama on wheels can come true.
This is something we'd never done before.
Our highway engineers know the way. It's ours for the asking.
And we drew the initial version of Clearview. We opened up the terminals. That is, unlike a Helvetica, where the E curls around on itself and completes the circle, the letter terminates with a straight, nearly straight stroke. So you don't create a trap for light because your eye closes a word up at great distances. And it worked. Different typefaces have different voices. They can be delicate, they can shout. And in this case with Clearview, the voice of it is as the invisible umpire. It has to make a good call. This 20% gain in legibility for the same size sign has saved many lives.
I can see clearly now, rain has gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright, bright sunshine day.
Don Meeker is a graphic designer. You can see some examples of the highway typefaces he talked about at studio360.org.
I think I can make it now, all the pain has gone.
Derek John produced our story.
All of the bad feelings have disappeared.
And that does it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you listen again next week. And don't forget that you can podcast our show anytime for free and follow us as well on Twitter and Facebook. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Dori Carr Harris,
Sarah Dalia,
Mary Du.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
When the successful playwright John Robin Bates headed out to Hollywood, he thought that being a TV writer for a while would be fun.
It was a nightmare. Just the fact that I came from New York, there was a kind of trope going around the studio. We can't have any of that Batesian angst.
The great playwright John Robin Bates, that's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.